Thanks, Charles. So this is the title, yes, Relativistic Chemistry Simulations of Pulsar Wind Nebula. And this is my group of plasma astrophysics in the University of Florence, led by Claudio Chiuderi and Marco Verdi. And we belong to the University of Florence. This work has been done in collaboration with Elena Matt and Niccolò Bucciantini, who are here, both from Florence. Now Niccolò Bucciantini is in Berkeley, and Delia Volpi is a student. So since I am the numerical guy in the group, I think I will talk a bit, but not too much, on the importance of numerical simulations and shock anchoring methods in high-energy astrophysics. So this is the outline. First, a bit on the code. Then I will introduce the topic, that is pulsar wind nebula, supernova remnants. First, some observations, and then especially the previous models. And then after the discovery of a jet torus structure in the Crab Nebula, but not also, in many objects, the theory, of course, has changed, and numerical simulations have confirmed an idea by Lyubarsky of how to explain this structure. And then some comparison with observations. So why numerical simulations is, well, kind of obvious, especially in high-energy astrophysics. Whenever you have sources of relativistic particles and high-energy emission, these are the typical animals that you have to deal with. And usually there are disks and jets, that is our topic, of course. And so these are very complex sources of flows. You have always relativistic flows and strong shocks. So the problem is very hard. Usually you should do 3D dynamics or relativistic plasmas. The solution to this problem is shock capturing codes for relativistics and HD. So the equations of relativistic MHD are basically the fluid equations plus Maxwell equations and the freezing condition of a vanishing electric field in the comoving frame. You can write the equations in this form that looks very similar to the usual MHD with the introduction of this covariant B. Actually, this B has the electric field included in the fine part here and this extra part here. So it's another form of writing the MHD equations. In the relativistic case, you can also do with your usual V and electric field. It's the same. Oh, these actually are fine also in general relativity. In the following, I will consider just special relativity. So the form in which the equations were written. Is the light on? I don't know. So these were a set of hyperbolic conservation laws, and there are these so-called Godunov schemes to solve them. And basically the steps are, you first discretize your variables, conservative variables U on a grid. Then there is the reconstruction of these variables at the interfaces, because you don't know the value of the interfaces, where you have to, you need this to calculate the derivatives. And this will change according to your accuracy, so it can be second order, third order, whatever. Then there is an approximate Riemann solver for fluxes, this is the upwind step. And then finally, time integration. The problem of MHD is that you cannot write exactly in this form, and also relativistic MHD, because of divergence of B. Because actually the induction equation for the magnetic field is in this form. And in the relativistic case, it's exactly the same. So you have a curve instead of a divergence. So you cannot use the same discretization as for the other variables. And you actually develop method to apply the so-called constraint transport staggered discretization, that actually what you need to define is B along the edges or the faces of a cube, because we what important is the circulation. What you conserve is the circulation of that equation. So different discretization, you have staggered B components. You have to use those staggered components when you define the fluxes to avoid monopoles. And then the magnetic fluxes are also different. So this is a bit technical, but our code is different from others in the sense that the solver is simpler. We only use two-wave solver, the so-called HLL. Sometimes these are called central type schemes. Basically, you just need to know the highest of the characteristic speeds at each interface. So no spectral decomposition. And this is important, especially in MHD, because you avoid a lot of degeneracies of the magnetic field. You have to consider when one component is zero, for example, you have several different cases. So this applies actually to classic MHD as well. When you move to relativistic MHD, you have to add some additional things and complications.
Actually, before you go, so the last point with the central scheme, so you have the advantage of not having to solve the Jacobian for the matrix, but what do you lose?
You lose, I have just simple test later. For example, contact discontinuities are a bit smeared compared to the shocks, for example. Shocks are captured pretty well, exactly the same as if you use row type fluxes. But contact discontinuities are a bit bent, maybe also Alfven discontinuities.
Question. So on your previous page, you said that dBdt is curl of u cross b couldn't be written in conservative form. But can't the curl of b cross b be written as divergence of u b plus b u?
You can write like this. See? But in any case, you have a component which is zero. For example, the derivative in x doesn't have this x part. Well, there are only two. If you are in 3D, there are only two things surviving of this.
Right. So, but it's still, it's still in conservative form.
Well, actually, not properly, because you need the information. For example, if you are in 2D, you have only. You have to define one single numerical flux. And then you can think in terms of magnetic potential, for example. So you must have combined information from X and Y. Well, if you just evolve that thing, that mathematically you could do it. But see, the errors cannot be taken into account properly, and the divergence of B just increases.
But that's not because it's not in conservative.
Yes.
That's just because there's a constraint equation there that you know.
Yes, but the only way to take it into account is to write it as a curve and keeping this in. Well, it's kind of different conservation equation. But yes, the main point is numerical. Analytically, it's basically the same. From a numerical point of view, you cannot just proceed in the usual way, because otherwise the divergence of B is lost after several time steps. So if you stagger instead on a cube like Anatoly showed last time, the magnetic field components and the electric fields, at second order you can maintain exactly this condition. Forever. You start with 10 to the minus 15, and that is preserved.
Right. So I understand errors in div b equals 0 not being preserved. So this method preserves that exactly. But it's not because it's non-conservative.
Well,
it's not because the original equations were non-conservative. The original equations were conservative.
there is another problem. Maybe it's problem strictly hyperbolicity in the sense that you can have degeneracies and all the eigenvalues are not different, for example. They collapse one on another.
So, if you could write as a sort of surface conservation law, where you can feel flux through the surface, magnetic flux through the surface, right? So it changes only because of the flow for the boundaries, right? Then in this form, you would preserve 0 dB. If it's initially 0 dB, it will stay 0 dB. And the flux for any closed surface will stay zero. In this sense, that would be a good approach. Okay? But if you do it as a volume conservation law, you don't have this simplicity.
So the extra complications when you move to the relativistic MHD are that now find the primitive variables, so your velocity components, pressure, and density from the one that you evolved in time, which are different, the conservative components. It's no longer simple set of expressions, but you have to solve a 5x5 nonlinear system. Actually, you, by projecting along B, you can reduce to a couple or even a single root finding method, so this is not a big problem. Then also to find the magnetosonic speeds that are required for your your Riemann solver, it's more complex. You have to solve now a quartic equation. And also eigenvectors are much more complex, but in my method, I don't need them. So everything explained in the papers. Yeah, once you have a shock capture in code, you can do, for example, Riemann problems. You have one state on one side, another on the right. You let them evolve, and you see all the structures. This is the problem that I have with contact discontinuities. So the shocks are treated pretty well, but and also rarefaction waves. The only problem is this one. So with magnetic field, you can 2D things like explosions in a magnetized medium. You can see, for example, the modification of the field lines. The Lorentz factor here is higher across the field, of course. You can do also jets, for example, as a test. You put something, this is cylindrical. You put something here, a velocity inlet. This is Mach 18, you let the thing evolve, and then it also
Look, you call these tests, but in what sense is this a test? I mean, are you comparing with somebody else's simulation, or?
Well, yeah, there were a lot. There were already some hydrodynamic relativistic simulations.
I think of a test is so you cannot say whether your code is working or not.
Yes, this is not a real test.
It's obviously working,
but. Yeah, of course, but when you have simple analytical solutions, it's fine.
Yes,
it's
yes.
Basically 1D. When it goes to 2D, you don't have so simple analytical solutions.
Yes.
So what you do, you just make sure that the scheme works in 2D. That's the first thing. Okay, that doesn't crash. That's one kind of a test. Then you compare with previous results made by different groups with different calls and see whether you get a similar number.
So for this case, do you get similar results as previous groups?
Yes, yes, yes. And also, it's important to see whether you have the development of the Kelvin-Helmholtz instabilities and so on.
This is without.
But this was just a nice picture.
This is without MHD or without magnetic field?
In this case, it's actually without.
Yeah.
If you put magnetic field along the z-axis, for example, you have a reduction of the production of the reason. So they look, it looks better. So now the introduction is over. Let's go to pulsar wind nebula. So pulsar wind, this is of course the crab that is the most famous one. This is a composite image. There is this so-called amorphous mass seen in X-rays, and these are the filaments around it due to the expanding supernova right now. So EWNs are just hot bubbles, sometimes called flareons, emitting non-thermal radiation, basically at all wavelengths. And of course, you have injection of relativistic particles and magnetic field. And these are originated by the confinement of the ultra-relativistic wind coming from the pulsar with the expanded supernova remnant. So you have a strong deceleration, shocks, and the hot bubble is created. This is again a sketch. So here you have the pulsar wind, ultra-relativistic. Here you have the termination shock. This is the bubble, so the PWM. These are the ejecta. Usually you can consider dense, cold material expanding. And the supernova shells with the outer shocks. So this is taken, I think, from 1990. So this is a zoom of what happens very inside the wind zone. So here you have the rotating dipole of the pulsar. We think that this would be inclined with respect to the axis, but rotation and magnetic field are inclined. So what you create after the light cylinder is a zone of magnetic field. Actually, the toroidal field changes signs, and you have a zone that is called the striped wind. Also, you start with a sigma which is much greater than one. It's predicted to be much greater than one near the pulsar, where sigma is basically the ratio of pointing flux to matter flux energy. So it initially is magnetically dominated, while the application of usually 1D models for the emission of a flareon predicts that at the shock the sigma must be less than one. So this is called the sigma paradox. So we don't know exactly what happens in the middle. For what my model is concerned, I just need to know that I have a sigma which is smaller than one when I arrive at the shock front. The B will be mainly toroidal because the other decreases faster. And probably there is a zone in the middle. We don't know the angle, that depends on the inclination of the rotator, where the magnetic field can be also zero, because you can have reconnection or fast mode dissipation at the termination shot. There are many models. So this is the scenario. All the theory maybe was Kenner Coronetti 84. It was analytic. This is for the nebula, of course. You assume that the wind terminates with a strong NHD shock. Then you solve the conditions at the termination shock. You can solve the equation. Everything is stationary here and 1D radial. They calculated the synchrotron emission. And then with the best fit, they got these parameters. So you have the dimension of the radius of termination shock, the luminosity, the gamma of the plasma arriving at the termination shock, also quite high, and the sigma that is supposed to be low, as I said. So the first thing we did was to make 1D simulations, and we had to compare with these analytical or semi-analytical 1D models. So basically,
in your simulation, you don't have any dissipation, right? Connection dissipation.
This is ideal, yes. So we take one.
But there's numerical
dissipation. Numerical dissipation, yes, there is always. Yes, but we don't have explicit terms. So this is thermal pressure, this is magnetic pressure. And they basically agree. Now, this is fine in 1D, of course.
Could you go back to the previous slide? What were you showing here?
Yes, the thermal pressure inside.
So the one is the theoretical one. Oh, no, what is the.
Yes.
Theoretical one is numerical?
Yes.
Yeah, one is showing that you're
emitting in the barrier. Yes, in the limit, yes. And
so
also.
This is a test.
For the analytic model. For the analytic model, yes.
The viewers got it right.
Yes. And don't get me done. Okay. So this was 1D. After the discovery of this kind of structures, especially by Chandra, these are both X-rays, Crown and the Vela, we had to do something more, something better than 1D models, of course. Especially also because these are not the only objects like this, but there are at least three or four more, and they all seem to have this torus and jet structure. This is something that never worked on projectors, I don't know why. There were movies here. That's first this one. This is not a real movie. You can download it from the web, but shows not even this one.
Black movie, that's right.
You can put those bits there.
There's a black hole.
Just on the screen.
There's a button to display.
I'm going to destroy everything now. Let's go. No, CRT.
TV. Or is it CRT?
It's only Malacca.
Try CRT.
Should I?
Or use Macintosh Keynote.
These are the famous WISPs. I only need this movie to say that there are motions in the equatorial plane, and these are the estimated velocities. It's only one.
All right. But it's
single. In this case, you can see the movement of the jets. Actually, there are only four snapshots taken some months in between. And you can see that polar jet motions are something like that. Yeah. So after that, so how do we explain the torus? The torus is not hard if you think that maybe you can have a higher energy flux on the equatorial plane, so you have higher emission, maybe it's easy. But the jet is a problem because, well, the first idea is to try to collimate a jet from inside the wind, because it looks as if it is originated from the pulsar region itself. But in a wind with gamma much greater than one, you have this term balancing the other. This is the usual term that can collimate magnetically the jet. So we have a problem. So it was proposed first by Bogolov and Kangulian, 2002, but especially by Lubarsky, 2002, that collimation can actually occur downstream of the termination shock. And first of all, you have the termination shock that is like this, no longer a sphere, and this is because of the higher equatorial energy flux. This works also on hydro, that problem. But since you have a flow that is no longer radial, you have flow in this region, especially in the equatorial region, after the termination shock. Then you know that you will have amplification of magnetic fields, like in the Kennedy-Coronitti model, inside the nebula. Inside the nebula, you no longer have gamma much greater than one. So say it's almost normal MHD, this term can be effective, and you can have the what so-called hoop stresses that divert the flow towards the axis. And the first to confirm
but this that's the box.
Yes. Yes. They said something different. They said that collimation can be again after, but they didn't understand the mechanism, I think. Only later they made another paper which came to the same conclusion. Maybe it was kind of Boolean.
So I would swap the marks from the to make the right order.
This is alphabetical.
We pass on wasting time over who gets credit. It really
I think they published the paper first, but then he got the right idea. So this is why I keep this ordering. But I always say that he.
So the idea is the pinch force of the terminal field, basically.
Yes. It's that can occur only in the nebula, not in the relativistic unit. And here maybe. It's difficult to see, but there are some errors. This is taken from Lubatsky paper, and it was just a drawing. But then Komissarov came and, of course, confirmed everything together with Lubatsky. And we started at the same time doing the same things, but unfortunately, we arrived a bit later, but I think we are doing the things correctly. So first, the assumptions. Basically, you have to initialize your problem with the wind conditions. And you can assign, for example, we choose an isotropic mass flux and an isotropic energy flux, basically giving this gamma as a function of theta. So we have this parameter alpha that controls how isotropic is the wind. Alpha equal 1, alpha equal 1 is isotropic, alpha equal 0 is some theta. Then you have to assign the toroidal magnetic field, and we started with something that goes like a sine, so without the striped region. So it has actually a maximum in the equatorial plane. Of course, then should revert its sign, but the dynamics is the same, because it goes everything the square of theta. So the parameters are the gamma, that must be much greater than 1, say the equatorial gamma, then this alpha, which is basically the ratio of the flux at the pole and at the equator, and the sigma, that is the usual parameter, less than 1. Simulation setup, well, we use our scheme. So this is, of course, 2D axisymmetric, and we have the velocity can be Vr and V theta, but we have only the toroidal magnetic field. So say it's just the next step beyond Kennedy and Coronitti by adding the other dimension, but the field is only toroidal. And we have pulsar that with a relativistic wind inside, then a spherical shell of expanding dense ejecta, and outside the static ISM. So this is a bit difficult to explain, but here you have distance radius in light years, and here the time. Actually, so this is the contact discontinuity, how it evolves, increases in time, and this is the termination shock. And then you have this process here are at the pole and here at the equator. So already from here we can see that the pulsar wind nebula is not spherical, but it will be elongated. And this is something known due to the magnetic forces must have this shape. And the termination shock is the opposite, is larger on the equator and narrower for the at the pole. Here are at different times the shape of the termination shock, for example. Yeah, this is the magnetic pinching effect. So this is actually the nebula. Here I'm showing the pressure. You can see it's elongated. And if you consider standard MHD without any velocity and so on, you apply cylindrical coordinates these two equations, and this term is the one that provides the pinching. Or here I show for different values of the magnetization sigma, it is increasing in this direction. Actually, the ratio, the elongation, say, the dimension at the pole divided by the ones at the equator. So it's something greater than one. And when the magnetization is higher, this is greater than in the other cases. Here, it happens that becomes spherical again because I'm hitting the boundaries of the expanding ejector. This is the so-called reverberation phase. So in the club, we are not yet in the reverberation phase. We have done some kind of longer simulations in that phase. This is an enlargement of the center region. So this is the termination shock. So what happens? This is your ultra-relativistic pulsar wind. Then you have the shape with the sudden transition here. Here the flow is still supersonic and also super magnetosonic up to here. This is called rim shock when you have the change of curvature. And here is the subsonic flow after the termination shock, like the one that you have in 1D. So we can see that the shape is very different from, of course, the radial case. And you have this strong equatorial flow here. So what happens to this equatorial flow? If sigma is small, basically nothing. You have this. So again, the red is the ultra-relativistic wind. Then you have the production of this equatorial flow. Then you hit the boundaries, you create these vortexes, and nothing happens. But if the sigma becomes larger and larger, you have these magnetic forces acting here. So you see there is something coming out from this equatorial flow. And for sigma basically greater than this value, you have very strong jet production along the axis.
So can you draw the streamlines exactly?
Yes, I think you can see better from this picture. Well, this is actually another case. It's a case in which I let the field go again to zero also at the equator. So it's this function here with B equals 10. This is pole, this is equator. So I allow for a presence of striped region on the equatorial plane. So the maximum of B is actually somewhere here. And is exactly where the field lines, well, the flow velocities, sorry, the streamlines are redirected towards the axis and the jet is created. But even if you take sine of theta, you have the same effect. The only difference is that you no longer have the equatorial flow. You only have jet, basically. This is something that I always notice when I have the ejector. And this is, I call it the crunching by instabilities at the contact discontinuity. Contact discontinuity, this is density, so the red here is actually the contact discontinuity. Here you have your usual structural pattern of velocities. But after this is time 200, so this is velocity, magnitude, and streamlines. This is magnetization, and this is density. same things below, but for a later time. So at a later time, the termination shock has expanded, everything looks similar, but if you look here, there are these red things protruding from the contact discontinuity, and this could be, well, Kelvin elbows instabilities, certainly, or shear instabilities, but I'm not sure whether these are amplified by the numerics or not. So it's something that we always see when we have, because there is a huge gradient in density at the contact.
Can you touch this again? Is it right on the edge of the box here?
These things coming from here. See? Now you don't see this anymore because it has expanded a bit. But it, and the whole nebula is a bit.
And your current distribution is what on the edge of the box?
Oh, the edge of the box is farther away. I have free streaming, say. I never reach the end of the box. So it's not the boundary conditions. It's only that the flow is moving along the contact discontinuity, which is a very steep density gradient. So instabilities are very easy to trivial. So this was discussed. So now, after these qualitative things, which you understand physics and you confirm the scenario of the production of the jet, we try to produce also maps, synchrotron maps. So what you can do is to assume a power law spectrum of electron energy at the termination shock. Then these energies are evolved along the streamlines, and you lose for adiabatic losses and synchrotron losses. Then you assume that the electrons emit only the peak at the visible frequency. Then you calculate the spectral emissivity function in the observer frame, and you need to do all the relativistic transformations. For example, here B prime pair means the component of P perpendicular to the direction of the observer in the comoving frame. So you have to translate them in the lab frame magnetic field. And then you have this Doppler factor here that is the one that will give the boosting effect. So, and then alpha is the spectral index here. And then you have to integrate along the line of sight to produce the synthetic maps. So you get something like this. So this is simulation with these two parameters. And you can see arcs, rings, you can see the knot that is both here and here. This is the torus, the part with the larger emissivity. And especially these two arcs resemble very much the one that you see in the villa, for example, that would correspond to the inner ring here and the torus of the crowd.
But again,
jet, yes, you cannot see the jet in our simulation because the magnetic field vanishes there. So you have to add some little trick. When you see in these images jets, it's because you must assume, for example, but of course, if you allow for 3D, you will have the jet even. But in 2D, this is forbidden, so you have to give a recipe, like take a small E in the other direction, proportional to maybe to the velocity, colloidal velocity. But, well, I cannot see that directly. Although sometimes there is an announcement also of pressure, and so not precisely on the axis, but near, I can see something like a jet. For example, here, so constraining the field shape. Actually, yes, the hope would be you have these three parameters like the magnetization and the shape of the magnetic field by comparing with observations. It would be great to be able to say something on the strike wind vision. In this case, for example, with the same magnetization and different shape of field, you can see, actually here the numbers are different. You can see maybe more structures in this case. The rings are kind of complete, while here the boosting is probably stronger and you only see the part on your side.
Is this the whole nebula? Is this the whole nebula?
The whole nebula? Oh, the whole nebula, yes. Here you have the quantum discontinuity, the boundary.
So what are those rings near the polar?
Yeah, I think it's when the flow hits the boundary and then it's diverted sometimes also in your direction and it starts to.
And the cooling time is very long in this case, right?
The cooling. Yes, in this case you can. Yeah, let's go to the next one. So this is the other issue, is to try to see differences in optical and X-ray, for example, because you are evolving also this max energy or cooling time required. So in X-ray, you lose some of the emission compared to optical. And so this is confirmed.
But the spectrum is just, you assume some arbitrary spectrum of the particles.
Right? You have to assume an alpha in the ejection spectrum. We take now the same index all around the termination shock. So it's isotropic also. And then, yeah, the distribution function evolves along the streamlines. And this is what happened. We tried even, this is something crazy that we are trying to do, to reproduce the observed spectrum. So what you do is to integrate your emission in the whole nebula. And so here we have, this is flux in millijans, these are the observations in the optical range. This is one that we found in the X-ray by Chandra. Then the red line is actually that provided by the observation. So it goes through here, and there is a break here due to synchrotron losses. So here we go from minus 0.8, I think, to minus 1.12, something like this, the spectral index. While the black line is what we find. So it's something lower here and too high in the X-rays. The situation is better in the for higher magnetic field, because B equals 10 means that it's almost a sine. So we get the proper thing here. Actually, the circle should be exactly on the line here, but it's an ideal problem.
So what's the difference between this?
This is higher magnetization. Sigma is the same, but the shape, because what we call sigma is the equatorial sigma, say. But then the shape is different. So if I have B equal 10, it's almost a full sine. So it's magnetic field strong at the equator. B equal 1 is very similar to your case, I think. You should have B 07 if I compare my model to yours. So a large striped vision. But what I call sigma is not the effective sigma, it's the one on the equatorial plane with the full sign.
What is this break you find?
Yes, the problem is that we don't find the right break. This is due to the synchrotron losses, but it should be here.
Yeah.
We find it here instead. If we go to higher magnetization, it's slightly better. It's around here, so it's difficult to say. And finally, the...
But I don't understand, you assume your spectrum is fixed. You assume constant injection, sort of.
Yes.
It's not like inject...
But that's a determination shock.
A determination shock, and then, it should fall down because of singular losses. The problems that we have is, I think, is that we don't have enough magnetic field in the whole nebula, because it's concentrated very near the termination shock. So when you do the integrated integrated spectrum, I think you need something more distributed.
So can I ask a question?
So this is always the problem. When you try to compare with numbers, never do this.
there's always the nice feature of never having to deal with data.
Mm-hmm.
And it could go on all sorts of interesting theories. Why did you choose? You've chosen to a modeling strategy where the known curvature of the observed spectrum from optical to X-ray is to be explained as synchrotron cooling.
Mm.
The tradition, and that leaves then there's also curvature in the spectrum as you go from
radio
infrared to radio. And the traditional interpretation is that break is the synchrotron cooling one, and mm-hmm. the optical to X-ray is it has to do with the intrinsic acceleration at the shock in this kind of model.
For us, it would be better because we could change
one can pursue any strategy. I would infer from the results you've shown that if I say sigma of the order of 0.01 or 0.03 or something like that is a good idea for the dynamical structure,
yes.
Then you are presenting evidence now that the termination shock does in fact have not a single power law spectrum generated there, but has got some sort of break in it.
So thank you very much. Yes, if we believe to this, of course you can. First of all, well, you need a higher sigma to produce the jet. So this is something that could be correct.
But you don't want to go.
Then,
how much higher a sigma can you go?
You went to 0.5, but what you have is you don't have a stationary solution, of course, because when the sigma is too high, you have vortexes everywhere, the termination shock is bouncing, maybe the wisps can be explained like this, of course. So this is work in progress, but we are trying to match observations as much as we can. And even to predict something that we don't have.
A simple question? Given that the spectrum depends on the shape, topology of the field that you put in, do we have the observational data on spectrum different parts of the?
There are, yes.
Yeah, but these are not.
This is integrated.
Are you going to show? I mean, that seems a more useful thing to compare.
Yes. Maybe we can try to do something. Yes.
And that is something that should be done. That is something that will
be. There are data.
There are data, yes. I think more is.
There are data, and that's something that will
be. Spatial result.
The resolution of spatial bands is very tricky to do.
It's not a bad hole.
No.
Okay.
Remember
the
paper by Morris.
In the optical, there are very good data on how the spectral index varies with
places.
So that is something that.
Even by chance.
But there are.
So
that I'm a little confused just as a complete amateur in this, a very just sort of very basic question. You're following these fluid elements and you're calculating how it's getting hot because of essentially shock heating and then the radiation subsequent to that. Right? Is this, are we expecting thermal heating here? Are we expecting the thermal spectrum? Is that what we're looking at?
We are only looking at synchrotron emission now.
It's non-thermal.
So non-thermal.
So yeah. How do you calculate the non-thermal emission?
You assume a power law produced at the shock.
You assume that you have a Gaussian and then power law, and the power law is what must be saying
exactly with the flow. There's no evidence anywhere for the Gaussian component.
Not even, yes.
What about the normalization?
Normalization, we do it
by the
pressure, actually. Use the pressure.
But yeah. Some finite fraction.
And those
yes,
rules
you
are derived
this
from where?
Three parameters.
From data.
You must assume a
these
fraction.
These observations, though. I mean,
yeah.
Optical and these observations of the network. So it's an incremental relation.
Yeah.
Can I ask also a naive question? So how does the, I was sold on these ion cyclotron motions that provide, explain the WISPs. So can I get a...
These guys don't believe in that.
They are, right.
They're pursuing a different model.
Right, but you actually do a kinetic model where you take into account what the particles are actually doing and you compute the radiation, don't you? And do you explain the spectrum that you observe, that's observed? Or?
You can take your time to discuss this, or should we wait till the end and we can discuss it?
Maybe we should wait till the end, but I want to hear
it.
It's his talk.
Not already at the end.
Not mine.
Okay.
I gave my talk.
But they didn't challenge you, and now I'm...
That's because they're polite.
Because we know each other.
Well, let's stop that right now.
Well, I was surprised that Komisarov didn't challenge what I was saying. He's not polite. Sorry.
Okay, but I'm right in thinking that there are these two conflicting models currently.
There are different models around.
Okay.
There's more than those two.
Okay.
And those are the ones that are here.
Well, we invited the best people.
Ooh.
Sorry.
So this is something that we have done here at AITP, that is try to do polarization maps also. So this is the polarized fraction. I'm not sure about this thing here, but it's one, say, or it's maximum where the field is ordered in the sense that you don't have mixing of things going one way and the other way. For example, here it's lower, and here it's a superposition of the polarized directions, although it's very hard to see, and the synchrotron emission map, the usual one. So now we are waiting for data. There is something in optical, but not very high resolution, and in X, I don't know if it's possible to have polarized.
I hope you live long enough to see X. Is this, what is the spatial scale on that map there? Where are we looking?
This is the torus.
That's the torus.
One
on the left is all the way out to the contact surface?
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And these are the runs with fixed external boundaries, so everything is spherical now. Maybe so I forgot to say this.
The existing optical polarization is the Veronsetti and Vulture map, I think.
The Vulture is one, actually, I think.
But the resolution is very poor.
One caution is your flow here is in the innermost regions, this relativistic flow is going out through this network of emission line filaments that's around.
Yes.
And when you get to the outer regions, the flow structure, especially the magnetic field structure, is going to get disrupted by that.
Sure.
In the innermost regions, it's probably not a problem, mm-hmm. but you have to look through the outermost regions to the innermost regions.
Yes.
So it's extremely exciting and interesting to have a higher resolution observational map to compare to this. But if it doesn't work out very well, it could be either because this is really in the wrong direction stuff, or because in reality you've got to take account of this extra corrupting influence.
Mm-hmm. That's why you want to look at high energy.
Yeah, but actually in the innermost regions you see it in the optical maps, in the optical polarization maps that you've got. A very well-defined trend, which is not what you expect, arising from the filaments. I mean, if you take a look at the map, you can see quite clearly which are the regions that are affected by the filaments and which.
Yeah, the innermost regions look like
right.
It's a toroidal field.
Right.
because the E vectors are all lined up along the long axis of the nebula.
Correct.
So that's so the polarization map on the right, you know, may well line up.
Yeah, of course, that is the one that you should compare.
In fact, I was always a bit surprised that the fact that you have to look through in the optical map through the surrounding stuff, that you're able to see such strong evidence for toroidal in the inner regions, and suggested that the filaments really are excluded from the central region, and the optical radiation is primarily inside the filamentary region.
That's also because when you look at the polarized radiation, you've got a chaotic medium in front of it that will not give you any official contribution. It was just
noise that you're observing. That's how chaotic it is. But anyway, this is off the point. Mm-hmm. It's not. Since it's 12 o'clock, summary and conclusions. So many also we never show a jetter of structure, Crab Villa, but also another four or five. The torus is explained with a higher equatorial energy flux. And the jet collimation, which is forbidden inside the wind, is possible maybe inside the PWM? And the answer is yes. And also, first, well, theory and then relativistic MHD simulations, axisymmetric simulations confirm this scenario. So, what we find is that the toroidal shape, the termination shock has a toroidal, well, toroidal shape, it's oblated like this. So a strong equatorial flow is produced. For sigma large enough, these hoop stresses can divert the flow toward the axis, and this is the jet, and we find the correct velocities, yes, that basically are observed. Then, if you allow for the ejector, the expanding ejector, you have also instabilities driven by these large vortices. Let me crunch the PWM. Simulated synchrotron maps resemble closely, I would say, X-ray images, as was found also by Professor Gay. And work in progress now is trying to constrain the B parameters that we have, the sigma and the shape of the field, with these maps, and then try to get better spectra and even maybe polarization maps. Thank you.